Thanks, John.
Good morning. It is my honor today to introduce our speaker, Judge Michael Streit, and he was one of the seven Iowa Supreme Court judges who ruled unanimously for marriage equality here in Iowa in 2009. Judge Streit was appointed to the Iowa Supreme Court by Governor Vilsack in 2001, and he served until 2010. While serving on the Supreme Court, he authored over 170 opinions, and he served as chair of the Rules Committee and on the Bar Admissions and Administrative Committees. He served as liaison to the 5th, 7th, and 8th Judicial Districts as well. A native of Sheldon, Iowa, Judge Streit received his bachelor's degree from the University of Iowa and his law degree from the San Diego School of Law. He was a member of the Blackstone Inn Court, where he served for 2 months in the British courts of London, Oxford, and Birmingham. Judge Streit has received many honors in his career, among them the Distinguished Alumni Award from the University of San Diego for his service to the profession and to the Iowa courts. In May of 2012, he was awarded the Profiles in Courage Award by Carolyn Kennedy on behalf of the John F. Kennedy Foundation. The award was presented to Judge Streit for conscientious and courageous leadership while he served on the Iowa Supreme Court. Please welcome Judge Michael Streit.
Thank you very much. That was a nice introduction. I'd like to thank Jonathan Wilson. Where did you go, John? Oh, he's way back there. He's like a supervising authority. He was so kind to ask me here to speak to you today about our marriage equality decision and the retention elections and the Profiles in Courage Award. I've always looked on with admiration as to Jonathan Wilson and his mistreatment on the school board elections years and years ago. As I'll say here in just a moment, this was an unexpected award given to us three justices that got voted out for what they perceived to be fitting for the Profiles in Courage. But Jonathan exhibited similar courage when he headed the Iowa School Board and the wrongful attacks that went against him. And I think everybody should thank him for what he did when he was on the school board and the progressive and thoughtful way that he directed the school system of Des Moines. So thank you again, Jonathan. I welcome the opportunity to be invited to the FFBC, the First Friday Breakfast Club. I have to chuckle. I think you should invite Representative Lyons from Hull, Iowa, to this, and he'll probably gladly come thinking that he's invited to the Future Farmers Breakfast Club of Iowa. He's not one of our bright lights in the legislature, and you'll get to know that when you get up there. You know you're going to go to the Senate. He's across the hallway. The Profiles in Courage Award that we received was totally unexpected. It was unexpected because when we cast our vote in Barnum, we weren't thinking about being courageous. When we went to Boston to receive this award, we had an adventure that was truly fulfilling for acknowledging what we did. It was a validation of what we did, similar to the validation the gay community felt after our decision. I got to meet Carolyn Kennedy. The first time I met her was due to trickery. I received an email from somebody from the Kennedy Foundation and said they're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy administration, which is true. I mean, it's a big event at the end of the Kennedy administration. And they were planning several events and several forums. And one of the issues is judicial independence and how that's come about and changed and matured in the 50 years since the Kennedy administration. And one of our staffers would like to talk to you. People in my industry, I was on the Supreme Court for about 10 years. people in our industry get wooed for speaking gigs by this type of thing. They'll talk to you, see if you are articulate and can walk and talk at the same time, and to see if you would be worthy to be part of a program. When I got that call or got that email from the Kennedy Foundation, I quickly called a friend of mine, Erwin Chemerinsky. He's a constitutional law scholar. He's the dean of the UC Riverside Law School, the newest state law school in California. And I had known him and used him to teach constitutional law here to the Iowa judges. I did a lot of work, education for judges, and I had recruited him and got to be a fairly good friend. He started out at USC and was dean at the Duke Law School and then came back to head UC Riverside. And I contacted him to say if he'd like to be part of this forum that they're planning at the Kennedy Foundation this year. And he quickly said, I'd love to. And we traded a few remarks that we had made on judicial independence, and I was kind of preparing to help feed him into the conference that I thought I was going to be invited to. So at approximately 10:15, well, no, it was precisely at 10:15, the phone rang as scheduled for the staffer to talk to me. And Justice Strait, this is Caroline Kennedy. Now, luckily, I had the presence. Oh, bullshit! Who is this? I had that thought in my head, but I said, "Oh, well, hello, Carolyn." I just stammered, and I think she's used to that. But I totally swallowed the story on I'd be talking to a low-level staffer at the institute. We talked for about a half hour. She asked me quite a few questions. We traded stories. As Jonathan knows, I'm kind of a storyteller, so of course I had to talk to her a little bit. Told her how I knew her uncles, Bob and Ted, both. And that was very nice. And she said I'd like to award you and the other two justices the Profiles and Courage Award if that was okay with you. Oh, I suppose we could do that. It's such an imposition. So I did consent to that, and we had a nice talk, and I hung up, so I did the immediate thing. I called Justice Turnus, Marcia Turnus. I go, Marcia, did you just get a call? Because she had told me she already talked to Chief Justice Turnus. And she goes, yeah, do you think it's real? And I go, it sounded like her, and everything. And then I says, you know, God, I talked to her almost a half hour, and I hear this pause at the other end. A half hour? I talked to her for like 3 minutes. Well, it's not my fault. But it did turn out. It was a beautiful welcome. We were welcomed to Boston by a wonderful people, a group of people that really have history in their hands. We were asked to make two speeches at this event. One, we had to pay the piper. They have a big gala fundraiser. They don't use the word fundraiser attached to it, but a gala event the night before, where the rich and famous come, they ask us to make a speech, and they ask to make the same speech that we're going to do at the Profiles and Courage Award the next day. In that, one of my ad lib remarks. I said my son Ashton was going to be here today, but he had an option of seeing the Celtics play in the first round of the playoffs or come to an event where he had to wear a suit and tie on 2 days in a row, and he took the Celtics over this. Of course, the next day he's kept, why is everybody asking me about the basketball game? It was interesting to be there. Joe Kennedy III, I saw this young guy working across the room. We had already been seated at one point, and I saw this one guy working his way across the room, and he was heading for me. And I, oh, he looks familiar. He looks like a Kennedy, and it turned out to be Joe Kennedy III, who actually last night won the Democratic primary for the next congressman from Newton, Massachusetts. It's Barney Frank's seat that he's retiring from right now. He's the son of Joe Kennedy, who's the oldest son of Robert Kennedy, not Robert Kennedy Jr., which is the third child of Robert. Oh, don't even try to figure out the Kennedy names. But it was interesting to have him come up, and he said, I really wanted to meet you. And we talked a few moments. Of course, he's just a young kid. He's 30 years old. And, of course, in my remarks, I I got political there for a moment. I just said, well, it was nice to meet the next congressman from Massachusetts. Ah! They all screamed. Oh, geez, that was kind of a political statement. Because this organization does pride itself on a pretty balanced board that does the picking of the people that receive this award. And fairly conservative people are on the board. It's not a profiles encourage making the right decisions, but it's supposed to be for making a courageous decision in what we do. Chris Dodd was in the audience. I got to say hi with him briefly. I met him years before in the green room when Culver got sworn in as governor, and they're lifelong friends, Chris Dodd and Culver. But I said it was good to hear that Chris Dodd is now on the board of directors of the Kennedy Foundation. It's good to have an Iowan representing being represented on this board, and they're all, what's he talking about? And I go, well, Chris Dodd, when he was campaigning for president, he lived here so long. He lived so long in Des Moines that he had children enrolled in school, which is true, and oh God, he just roared at that. There was a retired Chief Justice that I met in the process of all the receptions and meetings that we had. She's the retired Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court who authored their gay marriage decision, who I found out was a student greeter of Robert Kennedy in South Africa in 1966, where Robert Kennedy made the landmark speech against apartheid. She was a student representative of a group that invited him to speak in South Africa. She was the head of the student group itself was in jail. Little did I know that when I met her and talked to her briefly about Massachusetts, because I knew Justice Graney from that court. We had served on a lot of different committees together from that same court. Little did I know when I met her and talked to her of her role in the apartheid speech in South Africa, which was a key part of my speech at the award. We had approximately 100 Iowans, more than that, quite a bit more than that, like 120 Iowans fly out to Boston to be part of our award. My roommate from law school, he's retired. He's doing things better than you and I are, Jonathan. He's retired at age 60. You can see him. He's in episodes of Mad Men this year. You see mostly the back of his head. He's always in bar crowd scenes. He flew out with his wife, who was another classmate of mine in law school, and their daughter, who is a deputy DA in Ventura County, who's totally committed to marriage equality issues and issues surrounding judicial independence. We knew that our decision would be unpopular with many people. And we even knew that in the back of our minds, we could lose our jobs because of the votes in this case. However, we took an oath of office in which we promised to uphold the Constitution of the state of Iowa without fear, favor, or hope of reward. And that is what we did. The seven of us on the court had decided many years earlier that we would be a court of integrity, that we would decide cases fairly and impartially, and that our only allegiance was to the commitment to the rule of law. Those principles made our decision in Varnum very clear. Our founding fathers wisely created a government based upon the rule of law, but the rule of law cannot exist without judicial independence. When I speak of judicial independence in this context, I'm referring to the judiciary that makes decisions based upon a fair and uniform application of the law, independent of, free of, outside influence. Judicial independence does not give judges the freedom to rule as they wish or along a political agenda. It gives judges the freedom to rule as they must. This case wrote itself. Judicial independence is certainly tested when a judge knows his or her decision is contrary to popular opinion and perhaps will lead the voters to hold the judge accountable in the next election for ignoring the voters' views or wishes. Nonetheless, judges cannot base their decision on public opinion polls or the wishes of past or potential campaign contributors or on the judge's personal beliefs. Because when judges begin to do that, we cease to be a government based on law. But the preservation of our system of fair and impartial justice is not solely the responsibility of the judges. It is the responsibility of all citizens. There are forces in this country that seek to politicize the judiciary so judges will be selected not on the basis of their neutrality and good character, but based on the basis of their commitment to a particular ideology or to a certain view on specific issues. We must individually and collectively resist those efforts, whether they take the form of corporate campaign contributions or threats by groups with political or social agendas. Citizens must demand that judges be chosen or retained for their professional competency, for their ability to be fair and impartial, and for their commitment to look at the facts and issues of each case, and only then make up their minds on the outcome. An even more disturbing trend is the demonizing of judges and the increasing intimidation of the judiciary. In the campaign this last year, that was the specific goal, to send a message. Vanderplas told us that our goal is not this election alone, it's to send the word throughout the country that they're going to have to toe the line to what their theology is. We experienced all of this in our election in Iowa. Public officials and other leaders resort to name-calling and denigration rather than engaging in a civil discussion of the issues or constructive solutions, calling judges activists or elitists as nothing substantive to the public debate about the important concerns of our time. Only I do kind of like being called a black robe master. Michelle Bachman can turn a phrase, I will say that. This type of bullying behavior weakens the ability. I love this use of this word bullying in this context, because it is so apropos. Only I feel like the word bullying, that word, is kind of like when you saw your dad wearing a white belt and white shoes back in the early 70s, and you knew right then that trend was gone. The overuse of the word bullying, I just resent that they've taken that word and applied it so indiscriminately. But in the context of talking about marriage equality and the tactics of election, that word bullying really does apply. It weakens the ability of our courts to uphold the rule of law, to protect the social, political, economic, and civil rights of all citizens, not just those that are most vociferous, the most popular, the most organized, or the most powerful. At the end of the day, the debate about controversial court decisions and judges who make them boil down to a simple question that you should ask all your friends and neighbors: what kind of court system do Americans want? A court system that issues rulings based upon public opinion polls, campaign contributions, and political intimidation, or a court system that issues impartial rulings based upon the rule of law? If we as Americans value the rule of law, we must act as if we do. Efforts to intimidate the judiciary and to turn judges into politicians or theologians in robes undermine the fair and impartial justice and will over time destroy the ability and willingness of judges to do their duty as faithful guardians of our Constitution. Only through an unwavering commitment to an independent judiciary can we assure future generations that they too will enjoy a society safeguarded by courts that uphold everyone's rights, liberties, and freedom, a society governed by the rule of law. Right after our decision, after we filed our marriage equality case, 5 days later, the court received a handwritten letter, and we'll leave it up here for you to look at. I actually have a 3-foot by 5-foot one of those. When I had it copied, I didn't know how big 3 feet by 5 foot was. And it was refreshing. I was still a justice when I made that. And that sits in my office today, and it did it when I was in the judicial branch. It sits right next to a signed letter by Robert Kennedy, and a picture of Robert Kennedy, in which the letter he outlines the importance of the law and the judiciary and lawyers in our society. And he signed that letter a week before he was murdered. But this letter really brought home to me the duties of our court and how we honored those duties by our interpretation of the Iowa Equality Clause. The author, after a few introductory remarks too profane to read here, that's what I said at the Kennedy Award Ceremony, and it's a huge deal, very formal, 400 or 500 people at the award ceremony itself. He starts it out, cocksuckers. So you kind of get the sense of where this is going to go. And it's a file stamp. It's a file stamp document, and it's mailed to the Supreme Court, State of Iowa. And he wrote this out. I defended the likes of you as an American soldier in World War II in Korea. I put him at about 90 years old then. My dad's 91 or 2 and fought in World War II. He continues, I conclude that I served the wrong side. Hitler treated queers the way they should be treated in the gas chambers. You are bastards. That was breathtaking to read that hate. The emotion revealed was just stark. We cannot change such raw emotions and intense feeling with nuanced discussion. But this brought home to me what the gay community and families with gay members struggle with every day. It also satisfied me that we were right to resist political and expedient solutions to withstand the intimidation. People and forces exploited this fear in our election. They exploited the prejudice and the paranoia that that letter evidences. They pressured our court to follow the will of the people. No matter how manipulated or orchestrated, no matter how it violates the basic human rights of being treated as equally as all other citizens, such forces must be challenged. My hope is that we have contributed a tiny ripple of hope, and that this ripple builds a current that can sweep away this type of prejudice. The Profiles in Courage Award is made at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum. That library took from 1964 to 1979 to get built. It was a hard build. The library was designed by I.M. Pei, the same designer, part of the Des Moines Arts Center. Pei said this, and I think he's just referring to the Kennedy building, but he said this, one has to persist. You have to identify the important things, press for them, and not give up. What our court did was to justly and honestly interpret the Iowa Constitution that guarantees equality for all. We did this as political forces, seen and unseen, swirled around us. We identified the important things, fair and impartial judging, equal protection for all, and we press for them. Our accepting the award says that we will not give up. We will push forward. We will persist. Thank you very much for having me here today. Very kind of you. I will take some questions, though. It is interesting. Dean Gant, he's from Mason City. He's the president of the Iowa Coalition of FLAG. I loved when they sat down and figured out that name, FLAG. Parents and Families and Friends of Lesbian Gays. He was at the Democratic Convention. I sent him an email. I met Dean. Dean Vestal and I went up to a forum up in Wartburg College, and we had the executive director of Iowa for Freedom and this other gal, she's mostly anti-abortion. We went up to have a forum up there, and Dean was in the audience, and I knew him from his testimony against the amendment, the hearing at the Iowa House on the Iowa Amendment of the Constitution against gay marriage. And he came up and introduced himself later, but I still remember in their discussion, they were talking about how our opinion was not supported, that the studies show that families, heterosexual families, raise better kids. And the AMA, the APA, American Psychiatric Association, American Psychologists Association, have all waded in on this issue, and it doesn't show that. There is no science for that. The science does not support the conclusion that children raised in heterosexual homes turn out better than children raised in gay homes. And then she responded with, well, we have different science. And I, it was just staggering, that attitude. And that is what you struggle with. We didn't have that in that case. In fact, the trial court judge threw out the opinion studies, the theology studies that disguise themselves as scientific studies. We overruled the judge on that and said we'll bring it in, but it was still undisputed that there was no state interest for having a statute banning gay marriage. But we have a different science. At that point, somebody with Dean stood up, they were in the front row, stood up and looked at and just walked out. Oh, thank you for that statement. That's it's like Lennon said, you know, he was voting with his feet, so to speak. So anyway, Dean Geth, I had traded a few emails with him, and he emailed Jonathan, you'll get a kick out of this. He goes, Scott Brennan says hi. And I go, oh, I've been looking for him all week. I'm trying to settle a case for him. And I couldn't get, I get his phone mail and he's been gone. And now I know where he's at. He's at the Democratic Convention. So it was interesting. Dean stood right behind the two people that read the Iowa vote on Barack Obama in the picture. And he emailed me real quick that says, I'm going to be placed behind them, so take a look. And he was right there smiling. And it was good to see him getting that kind of public recognition. I will answer any questions. Maybe an elephant in the room is our current election going on with Justice Wiggins, but I can answer any questions about the Varm decision or the Kennedy Awards or anything about our courts as you want. So any questions you really felt you wanted to ask about that speeding ticket you got or things like that. Anybody want to ask any? Okay, here we go.
Well, there was a Duffy cartoon about that had Wiggins saying, I don't remember exactly what it said, but I can't defend myself. And with Vanderplatz, the sword. But is that really, isn't there a way that Wiggins could stand up in some way? I mean, it just seems like the silence.
That's a great question. Yes, he can wade into the politics of what we're talking about. I gave some remarks to the American Judges Association in Nashville this year at their annual meeting, and I thought he was going to be asked to come for about an hour, and I was on stage for almost 4 hours, not me talking constantly, and that'd be such a thrill. But as far as the current state of Iowa law, we had no regulations, ethical decisions on judges before we adopted the Code of Judicial Conduct early in 2010. And we hadn't touched those in 30 years. They were so outdated. And it provided for what judges can and cannot do in elections. He can certainly form committees and have those committees crank it up. And theoretically, they're supposed to be blind committees. You don't know who's donating money to you and who's not. Under Iowa statute, the candidate has to sign a certificate, though, that lists all the donors. So theoretically, they're going to find out who. He can say that I don't look at this. But he's reluctant to wade into that. He can if he wants to. When we amended our ethics rules, the Supreme Court adopted the current uniform rule. We didn't make them up. We just adopted the national standard on ethics for judges. The Iowa Bar really just about had a cowl, saying, you're going into politics. Don't, because our decision had already been issued in the gay marriage case. And they took our amending the rules as a signal that we were going to get involved in politics. And, of course, our three justices are prime examples of not being involved in politics, perhaps. But we said, no, we're going to the uniform standard, and if they are involved in politics, here's some of the ethics that you have to follow. And at that meeting, a former president of the Iowa Bar stood up and said, don't form committees, don't become politicians. We want a fair and independent judiciary, not somebody raising funds for committees and being involved in that process. Do not do this. We will protect you. Now, as we saw, the Bar Association and all of us took this threat not heavily enough. Now, Turnus and I and Baker knew very well. We were pushing people to try to get involved. Please do something. And they did, but it was too late and too small. And it was about October before any real serious fundraising was done. There was a couple, there was a commercial shot, but it was only an internet commercial. Governor Ray shot a nice radio commercial. It was poorly done because he concedes that we made a mistake, which we never did feel that we made a mistake. He says, do you really want to fire the umpire just because they have one bad call? Well, that concedes a lot of ground there when you start it out that way. But we will protect you. As I told the American Judges Association, and I've said it, we did an autopsy after the election with the Bar Association. And in the conclusion of that, I said, you guys are ill-equipped to run campaigns, and you shouldn't even say we will protect you. They didn't know it at the time, though, what it was going to happen, but they are ill-equipped. Justice Wiggins can raise money, form committees, and start the campaign. Whether or not he does that, I don't know. I think he's laying low. That I have evidence that we don't want to wake up that sleeping bear of the 250 evangelical ministers that preach every Sunday. I've been hugged by an evangelical saying, we're not all like that. But they really are the boots on the ground for the Vanderplas organization, and they're an effective group. I mean, how does Rick Santorum win the Iowa caucuses based upon Vanderplas's endorsement of him without that army of evangelical ministers? So I'm not saying that we don't want to rustle or shake the waters here and start a problem. That was the problem, I think, with our election, is that we thought, and that's what all judges are like that, especially for merit selection states. And there's only about a dozen states that have this system. It's a great system. It keeps us out of politics. I was a judge for over 27 years. It kind of rankles me a little bit to watch, oh, we beat these judges. And, you know, you're beating people that never have been involved in politics, wouldn't know how to begin. And we cannot go to political parties or political organization as judges. Ethically, he can campaign, but he can't go to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party and say, help me out in this election, vote for me, and I'll set you free. He can't do that. I've probably gotten, I'd say, six requests from Democratic Party organizations asking me to speak. I said no to all of them, and I'm so naive. And the reason I do it, I probably will concede eventually here. I told one, well, if I do it, my first line in my speech will be contrary to what most speakers say. And my first line, say if I went to the Story County Democrat, and that's a really strong group up there. My first line of my speech is, I am sorry to be here today. Because I don't want the issue on marriage equality and the issue on the courts to be identified as a partisan, political effort, a Republican-Democrat effort. I just think I'm kidding myself on that, though. I mean, the Republican Party is fully, full-throated, endorsed the other side of judicial independence and marriage equality. I don't know why I'm kidding myself. I still resist it from taking a partisan political side. So if Justice Wiggins does start work, he can do that, but he can't go to partisan political organizations. One of the judges, he's on Supreme Court now down in Alabama, Justice Parker. If you go to his one of the judges that campaigned against us up here, he was here personally. Justice Moore was also up here. He's the candidate for Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. He's the one that was removed for refusing to take the 2.5-ton granite monument to the Ten Commandments out of the rotunda of the Supreme Court building. They both campaigned up here. But if you go to their websites or Justice Parker's website, he's a Tea Party judge. I mean, what does that tell you on your case when you have to come before that judge to decide any of those issues that Tea Party people have voiced opinions on? It's not a fair and impartial judiciary that is elected, that is selected and chosen to sit on the court that's a product of that process. So Justice Wiggins, I think he doesn't want to get involved in the way politicians would. He's hoping they'll go away. I think he is sadly mistaken on that. I hope the people of Iowa will have the buyer's remorse that everyone tells us they have about the three judges that were voted off. But I just hope that he makes it through with what he's doing right now. But it's not because he can't. He can. But he's also, he just does not. It's going to change our judiciary if we campaign. The downside of that is it's going to change the judiciary if he doesn't campaign. So I don't know the good solution here. It's really good. It's easy to be an expert from my point of view. My son plays soccer, and boy, we are excellent soccer coaches from the sidelines. But it's like we were getting our butts handed to us out in West Des Moines. They have a really strong soccer program. About a year ago, and we had a woman on our team, or a young girl on our team, and her mom was yelling at her pretty good. In our genre of soccer in Johnston, we really have been schooled fairly well to be quiet. You can, well done, and things like that, but we're not supposed to be going, get your ass going, or run. We're not supposed to give them that kind of coaching. But mom was telling her daughter, Haley, keep going. God, Haley, get after the ball. And Haley stops midfield. The play went on. Stops midfield, looks at her mom. It's hard. So, you know, I can be a little critical of Justice Wiggins, but if I was where he would, I think I'd like to stop up short and say, it's hard. He's in a tough dilemma. It would really change judiciary. And it's a long-run problem, because what do we end up on the bench then? Who gets on the bench? If you go to national meetings with elected judges that come out of the political process, they are a stark different quality of judge than the ones that come into the Iowa courtrooms. They are different people. I would wager when you go to a judges' conference, we put on two of those a year, one big one for sure. There's usually about 180 judges from Iowa. All these Iowa judges all come together, and they do that because it's free. But when you look out over the audience, and this is a quality judiciary, half those people would not be there if it was an elected judiciary. I just guarantee you that. And you know, judges from other states are quality judges, you can, and so forth, but there are many, many, many more exceptions to the, he's a good judge, she does a really good job. Oh, that one's bad. There's way more of those last conversations with elected judges, because there's a different quality of person, different set of talents that come to bear to get elected. So that's a long answer to that short question. Go ahead.
I'm just curious. I know the seven of you were unanimous in your decision. Were you pretty much all seven on the same page to begin with when you began your discussion? Did you bat it back and forth? I'm just curious without naming names.
Well,
I know you can't.
I'll tell you what Wiggins thought. No, I... This case was argued, it was an hour argument, it was scheduled for an hour, it lasted an hour and a half.
You were there.
That's right, you were there. As with every one of our cases, we talk about the case immediately after it's argued, no matter what case it is, and we have a conference. The case is assigned to a writing justice before the oral arguments, and their responsibility is to shepherd it through the court system, through the courts, through the judges. And so when they get done, a presentation starts. And there's a lot of pressure on your presentation. It's like a little mini speech. And what you're doing is putting forth your view of how the case was argued, was presented, and your recommendations on how it goes. We hate it when judges summarize what was done and says, well, I can go either way. Let's start the talk. And then, well, no. Tell us where you think you want to go. And then we go around the table and vote. And that process that day took a couple hours. We spent an hour and a half in the courtroom, a couple hours arguing the case. And we have a rule that you cannot join the conversation, you cannot say anything until it's come to you to join the conversation. And once you've joined it, then you can talk freely. So Justice Cady made his remarks to his recommendation and so forth, and we're all nodding our head. And then I went to Justice Heck, And other people want to jump right in, okay? But you cannot join the conversation until it's your turn. And once you join, then you're free to come back and forth, but it's a real structured environment. And we don't sit in the, we don't do that in the way of seniority. We do that in where we sit at the table. And it went to Justice Heck, and it went to me, and Justice Baker, and Justice Wiggins, and then Turnus, and then Apple, and went in that order around the table. Now, to answer your question, we all have a little different way we are going to skin that cat. Of course, I don't know why people skin cats anyway, but we had, because the other big competing theoretical area is due process, and due process is a little to keep going with it, a little hairier beast to deal with. Especially when they use that lends itself to an in absurdum argument. Well, you can marry your radio then if you want to. Under due process, polygamy and incest and things like that can drag their ugly faces into the argument. And for some of those type of reasons, we stayed clear of that and we went just with equal protection. But there was a divergence on due process versus equal protection, or both of them. Our district court judge here went with both. He found it violated due process and equal protection, both. But as we got around the table, we had a few different opinions on how to exactly deal with it. But it got done that day, and the last justice spoke, Justice Apple, and we all were just stunned. It was just, oh my God, this is going to be unanimous. We just pushed back from the table, and it was just quite a moment that we all realized where this was going. And Justice Turnus, you know, slapped us and told us, snap out of it, you guys. Well, Mark, try to get this out as soon as you can and start working on it. And he circulated the opinion, and it got rotated and rotated. And we actually went through the opinion line by line, probably five times. We put it up on the board and went through. Well, you can't say it that way. Don't forget that McGranahan case held this. And, okay, if we take that out or we can put it in, why don't we bring that in? And we did just the nuts and bolts of editing, which is really bad. Decisions written by committee tend to be boring. In fact, when it was all over our last edit, I went into Mark and I were probably the closest on the court because we came up from district court together. We both started about the same time, and he was just sitting there, and he did a masterful, beautiful job written. If I had any, I can pick out a couple lines that I did, but he wrote the opinion. But my input was about once an hour, saying, "Who is our audience?" And in writing world, that's really key for judges. I've taught legal writing, and sometimes your audience isn't the public. Sometimes your audience are law professors. Sometimes it's legislators, and they write for you guys, and so forth. But I would just remind, we thought our audience was the people that are gonna, the people of the state of Iowa. We weren't writing for the politicians. We weren't writing for law professors. If you read some of the other opinions written in this area, some of them are 200 pages long. Blah, 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 blah. And it's really, nobody gets through that. It's people complain about our decision that it was 69 pages long. Well, that's the short one in the world in this area, because this is a tough area to discuss. I just love our big opponent, Enterplatt, says, well, I don't think he read it, but I didn't even understand it, so I know I really want to attack it now. One of the biggest things we try to teach judges and lawyers is to learn how to listen. Listening is a hard trait. We are poor listeners because we always want to keep reloading and reattacking, and we don't care what anybody thinks. But if you listen, it'll lead to better understanding. You'll be a better judge and a better lawyer. But Vanderplatz doesn't understand the decision. He just doesn't understand it, because I don't think he's read it in complete. He just has the policy thoughts. He doesn't. We use a different set of criteria to decide what's constitutional and what's not. And public policy, or policy that politicians would bring to bear, is one of the least considerations that we have. But in the opinion writing, I think it was important that who is your audience. My dentist is up on 42nd and University up there, and I went in a short time after that to get my teeth cleaned and so forth, and the receptionist Christy, she, oh, I read that decision. It was so wonderful. It's so good. I read it twice. Well, thank you. That's more than a lot of people. Okay. But anyway, so that's how it initially started. We rewrote and rewrote, and then we got pretty well done with it. We had weekly meetings on the decision, and people put in inputs, and I can name you some of the justices that they put their little section here and a section there, and things got written out. Oh, I didn't feel, but Katie was just kind of, oh, and I go, what's wrong? Oh, they sucked the life out of it. And I go, well, that's what you do when you write it with committees. And he's wrong on that. It isn't poorly written. It still has a lot of vitality, and it's well written. And I have not seen any regular constitutional scholars that ever have attacked this decision. It's been read by everybody. Carolyn Kennedy talked to me personally about how beautifully it was written. The only attackers are the hacks in the industry, in the hate industry, that say it's not. It's one of the worst written decisions I've ever seen, is what Bob said. Or I've been told by a law professor that it's the worst decision he's ever read, and so forth. But when it got done, there were certain politics to play, because the legislature was still in session. The firestorm could start now, or we could hold it a year. The experts, and you were told this, the experts said, well, it could be up to a year. We've had cases penned for 18 months when it's been rewritten. I had a case that I had to hold till we decided one in front of us. It was on a medical malpractice case. So my case, I didn't really start a circulation of an opinion until well over a year after it was submitted. That's wrong. Our system should figure out how to do it quicker. But they were predicting it would take us a year to issue this opinion. And we got done in about 3 months. But it was meetings and meetings and going over and circulating drafts. And it was pretty well done. And we said, well, are we going to issue the opinion? And Justice Turnus, she is a rudder that guides us. And she did a great job on this. She goes, God damn it. She uses worse language than that, actually. We are not supposed to be involved in politics. If we're done with it, let's issue it. And if we held it till the legislature left town, they would accuse us of doing that. And so when we were done with it, we issued it. They had a chance to respond. This was just a little political fact that just irritates me, is that we issued that because we were done with it. And the legislature could start the constitutional amendment process. They had like 3 or 4 weeks to do that. They didn't get it done. They didn't get it done the next year. Our method of amending our Constitution is arduous, but it hasn't been done. And we have nothing to do with that. And we've given them every opportunity. And the 2 or 3 year delay, I think, is to our benefit. People are finally, growing into being accustomed to this concept and this idea and accepting of people as being equal. One of the most articulate statements made to me is, why I have a beautiful marriage and my daughter is gay. Why can't she have the wonderful life that I have and be married to the person they're committed to? And that's the guts of that problem or that issue. Why can't we have equality? And our people are growing to accept it. Our arduous process of amendment. Now, the thing is that it'll come up. It'll be. Let's just say it does get on our ballot. Believe me, the evangelical community is well organized. When we were campaigning, I probably spoke on an average about 3 to 4 times a week, mostly to Rotary clubs. And I think I won the Rotary vote, but. We had no public campaign to convince voters, the 500,000 people that cast ballots, to vote yes. Well, there was over 1 million. It was over 500,000 on each side. We had no political campaign, no commercials. Where I had a friend call up and said, I'm sick of watching your head twirl around on that lazy Susan that's in their commercial. Aren't you getting dizzy? the political process... is ill-suited for picking judges because of the kind of judges we get and the kind of commitments. The worst thing is actually not that. The worst thing that happens with an elected judiciary is the commitments that they have to make to people. And they set expectations. And then they set them or they let other people set expectations for them. And then they have to live up to their expectations. And they will do their decisions according to what they said they were going to be like, as opposed to what. How does that statute read? How does the Constitution read? Things like that. I had a friend that was, I won't give you his name, but he's a judge here in town. He went to interview with one of the commissioners, and the nominating commission, our merit selection. The commissioner says, well, what kind of judge? He was already a judge. He's on the appellate courts now. I'll give you that much. And he goes, what kind of judge are you? And he goes, well, I'm not sure that labeling is helpful. Of course, he wants to hear, well, I'm a tough judge. But that tough judge, is that tough judge going to find that the search of the automobile was illegal or unconstitutional? No, he's a tough judge. He's there with a mission. And so he pushed back and said, well, I don't think that kind of labeling is helpful, because I wouldn't want to pick people that say they're a tough judge or I'm an easy judge. So he declined to put himself in a box. And of course, he calls me on his cell phone as he's driving back home. And he goes, well, I think I just lost a vote. Why is that? And he told me that story. And I go, well, you know, I've interviewed with him. And yeah, I think he did lose his vote. In all the people that I got interviewed by, that one particular commissioner is the only one that asked me about abortion and straight out. When is the state of Iowa going to respect human life? And I danced around it as any politician would. Jonathan, he's creeping up here. We had one more. We had one more question, maybe right here.
Yeah, and when I they part broadcast the argument at the library here in town, I watched it, and after a while, you know, I started feeling a little bit sorry for either the county attorney and the attorney general. That their arguments were, you know, so pitiful, and I felt that the judges were feeling that as well. And,
You might have felt that when I asked that question, because one of the questions in my questioning, I asked this is just an absolute parallel to the questioning that went on involving interracial marriage coming out of the Loving case and interracial marriage out of Texas, those cases, and all the arguments against gay marriage were lodged against interracial marriage, that we have a state interest to control how people are raised. Studies show that children raised in one race couples are better or not. But I asked, you know, isn't this the same argument? And then I always said, well, don't. I was asking your attorneys, well, shouldn't we let the state have a chance to regulate to have better children or something? And I flipped that same one to the county attorney. And I think I got a little sarcastic, which I find in the appellate work, it's not a good thing to be sarcastic. And I go, well, how's that working out for you? When this heterosexual couple, because something like 40 to 50% of children are born outside of any marriage. Are you going to ban that too then, and so forth? But I gave some remarks during the before the election to the Reconciled Church, the United Methodist Church out in, I think it's probably Grimes, or it's out towards Waukee, I guess it is. It's right past the big Dodge dealership, Stu Hansen Dodge. That church there is very accepting. Those churches have gone through battles on this issue, but anyway, they invited me to come speak. And I had we had a big house for this. A lot of people from outside the church came to these remarks. And somebody asked me, well, it was a well-argued case, and I did the perfunctory thing. And one of the people that had asked a question during my remarks, as I said, just ask me as we go, he came up later, I got a bone to pick with you. And I go, oh, okay, here it comes. And he goes, it was not a well-argued case. Because he had the same remark you had. And it's just, like I said, this case wrote itself. If you really respect constitutional law and the writings in this area, it was, this is hard to say it quite this way, and it was an easy write. The case wrote itself, and it was hard to argue. And their spirit was in it, but they just had a bad case. I just didn't think they were maybe equipped to hit such a hot court. And we tried to throw them some softballs, but they just struggled. But my new friend, he invited me eventually to come speak at the Westminster Church, which is a mega church, which I had 250 people in the church basement for about an hour and a half. And finally, the minister came down and says, church is starting 5 minutes ago. So I said, okay, I know you have a lot of questions. We'll take a break. Everybody go up to church. I'll stay and answer a few questions if anybody wants to stay. And nobody left. So the minister said, I want you to invite you back to our church to speak. Only you're going to be upstairs at the pulpit. Oh, well, thank you. I'll be back and stuff. But it was a hard case. I think they argued as best they could. I think there's reasons why the Attorney General's office did not take that case to argue. They saw that there's politics involved in it, but also I think they just saw that it was not a very good case. The district court judge did a wonderful job in his ruling, Judge Hansen, and I think they just had a hard road to hoe. When I was writing on the appellate courts, we would set out, a lot of times we thought we're going to rule this way, and we had a theme in my little law firm, me and my one law clerk. If we have to work this hard to get to this decision, there must be something wrong with it. Because, the case does this and that, there's other, we can't write that way because that one statute says this, and that one case, and if you find you're working really hard to come to a certain decision in the appellate world, you're working too hard. And you might be in the wrong way you're going on the case. Judge Heck, one of his very first decisions, he proudly announced how he was ruling, and he handed it out. He had already written the decision. He handed it out, and I always spoke immediately after him. We speak in that role, in that order, around the table. And everybody was kind of looking at it, and I finally talked about it. Daryl, you're working too hard. you just can't get there on the way you're doing it here. And everybody went like that. And then we worked with the decision. He eventually changed, and he was working too hard. This case was not hard. Now, if you bring certain prejudices and biases, thoughts on gay marriage, that you don't agree with gay marriage and all those concepts, to the table, maybe it wouldn't be hard. But our people, every one of us are heterosexual. None of us has brought any of those agendas one way or the other to the table. And with that, I think it was an easy ride. We didn't let any of those opinions interfere with what we did. Jonathan wants to let you guys go from breakfast. Thank you very much for having me.
I want to thank you very much, Justice, for being here. We have a token of appreciation, which we traditionally give, which is a CD of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus.
Oh,
so as you are sitting quietly to reflect upon the last couple of years, this will give you some nice music.
A century ago, I was on the Des Moines chorus, and half these people were with me. So it's good to see my friends singing on. So thank you again.